call a meal without any meat? For many of us, that's just a salad course. Meat is at the center of the American diet. It's at the center of our lives. Americans eat more meat per person than just about any other nation on earth. But how much do we know about that steak or that burger? I'm Jeremy Bernfeld in for Steve Kraske, and today on Up to Date, we're going inside the meat industry. It's a complex world, and these days, it's controversial. Author Maureen Ogle examines this world and traces the history of meat in this country in her new book. It's called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. It goes all the way back to the first American settlers and dives into the relationship we have with meat, where it comes from, and why we eat so much of it. We'll speak with her in just a minute. Later this hour, we celebrate 10 years of StoryCorps. StoryCorps founder Dave Isay joins us to talk about a new compilation of stories and the upcoming National Day of Listening. Finally this hour, Home Sweet Home for the Chiefs with sports commentator Victor Wishna. But first, meat. Maureen Ogle joins us this morning from NPR's New York Bureau. Maureen, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Maureen, this book is called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Are we a carnivorous nation?
Yes. yes, we are. We are. According to a recent survey taken in, 2011 or 2012, only Luxembourg, of all things, eats more meat than Americans do. Yes, this is a carnivorous nation.
So a lot of the book is devoted to how our current food system was created. Can you walk us through what our food system looks like today? You know, what do we mean when we say conventional meat production or industrial agriculture?
First of all, should I explain why farmers don't like you to use the term industrial agriculture? Our food system is, at its heart, quite simple. It's designed to feed an urban majority. That's the driving force behind it. Most of us live in cities, and most of us don't produce our own food because we do live in cities. And so the agricultural system that we have, including the part of it that's devoted to making meat, is designed to produce a great deal of food at the lowest possible cost because urbanites don't like paying a lot for food. And in some sense, that's sort of the heart and soul of a consumer economy like ours. So everything that critics complain about in the meat system that we have today has emerged over the years, not through some, you know, malevolent plot on the part of whoever, but it's developed over about 150 years to feed people who don't make their own food.
So what are the advantages of industrial agriculture or conventional farming, conventional meat production? You know, why did the system develop? Why did we develop the system the way it is today?
The system that we have now really began to take shape about a century ago. The standard wisdom about it is that it emerged after World War II because of subsidies for corn growers. That's frankly not accurate at all. It emerged at a time when more and more Americans wanted to live in cities, and the more people who moved to cities, the fewer farmers there were. And that put a tremendous burden on those farmers who, I should add, a century ago did not have anything like the kinds of technology that farmers have today. And as more people move to city, the gap between the amount of meat that farmers could livestock and meat that could be produced constantly lagged the demand on the part of consumers. And that was true, by the way, of all foods, not just meat. And as a result, farmers and urban voters and the USDA and politicians all agreed that farming in the United States needed to be much more efficient and needed to run more like a factory than what many people think a farm should be like in order to reduce farmers' production costs and therefore keep the cost of food down. So little by little over the course of this century, all the things that we have now in the food system, which again are much criticized now, gradually took shape.
You know, you're nodding there to the criticisms. I mean, there are plenty of people kind of opposed to the way that our meat system is set up now. You know, they say it takes way too many resources, causes pollution, too many chemicals and antibiotics. It requires too many government subsidies. So how do you handle that part of this in the book?
Well, I should perhaps explain to your listeners. I don't actually have any skin in this game at all, by the way. I didn't have an agenda when I wrote the book. I'm not an apologist for farmers, the meat industry, or anything else. I'm a historian, pure and simple, and 7 years ago, I thought this would be an interesting book to write. I had no idea at the time that when I started the book that meat was going to turn out to be as controversial as it is. So it was never my intention to defend livestock or meat production or consumption in this country. And I don't think that the book does defend it. I think what the book does do is explain what happened. It, frankly, as I wrote the book during the 7 years that I was working on it, I became more and more aware of this extraordinary controversy about not just the role of meat in our diet, but the way livestock is produced and meat is processed. So I don't address any of those things directly, but by default, I've somehow turned into not quite an apologist, but an explainer. I'm an explainer.
Yeah, and as you said, a historian who can kind of trace the founding of this industry and the
right.
the way that it's developed. You were just speaking there about the controversies. I'd like to read a short quote from the introduction of the book. The battles over production and consumption of meat are nearly as ferocious as those over gays, gun control, and marriage. How did we get to that point?
Well, I think a lot, there are a lot of factors. How much time have we got? I actually ended up devoting the last, about the last third of the book. By default, I inadvertently ended up explaining how all this started. Much of the criticism that of meat right now, this moment in the United States, is due in part because of Michael Pollan's extraordinarily successful 2006 book, Omnivore's Dilemma. Weirdly, that book came out literally the same day that my last book, which is a history of meat of beer in America, came out. So I was actually off promoting another book while his book came out. I didn't even realize the book was around until about 2 years after I started writing this book about meat, and I became aware that there was this tremendous controversy. So that has been sort of the fulcrum or the axis on which controversy rotates right now, the Pollan-esque view. But there was a long period preceding his book, starting really in the 1970s, 1980s, a substantial critique of agricultural production in general. And over the years, that critique of agriculture in general, that environmental critique, expanded in many forms. But one of them was that the production of meat, sort of the bottom line criticism of it now, is that it's environmentally damaging and that it's all because big corporations are in pursuit of profit and they're destroying rural America and have run family farmers off the land and so on and so forth. So the critique... there's sort of the Pollan-esque one today, but then there's this long historical background, which most people don't have any reason to know about unless they're historians.
We're talking about the history of meat production and consumption in the U.S. this hour. Our guests are Maureen Ogle and, in just a minute, Peggy Lowe. Maureen is the author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to have you on. Our number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I would like to bring in Peggy now to the conversation. Peggy Lowe is my colleague. She's a reporter here at KCUR and Harvest Public Media. Peggy, thanks so much for coming on.
Certainly. And good morning, Maureen.
Good morning. It's nice to meet you over here.
Ditto. I follow you on Twitter. You have quite a great Twitter following.
Oh, my goodness. Now, is that? Okay. Anyway, thanks.
That's okay. Yeah.
Peggy, you and I both cover food and food production at Harvest Public Media. To the point that Maureen and I were just talking about, you see every day how divisive this food production issue is, right?
Absolutely. And I love how Maureen is talking right now about her role as an explainer. I feel the same way, you know, because we're journalists, we're reporters, and we're showing both sides of it. And I, too, Maureen, was very surprised. I came back to the Midwest. I'm originally from Nebraska, and I came back to the Midwest 2 years ago as a longtime journalist at West. And I, too, was surprised at what you call extraordinarily controversial, this idea of the way we produce food in this country. And the best way I explain it is it's kind of red state, blue state. Like you say, there's the Pollan-esques. And then there's the other side of it. So It sounds to me like you are defending yourself a bit in this history that you've written of me. Do you feel like that?
I didn't until people started finding out that I'd written this book. It's not fun to be accused of being a shill for corporations. It's not fun for people to say that I was obviously paid large money by Monsanto or some other corporation to write this book. I assure everyone who's listening, I only wish someone had paid me to write this book. Seriously. I'm not a shill. I'm not an apologist. I'm a historian. And we have so little experience with history in the U.S. that I think Americans don't even understand that what historians do. So when they read a book that just takes, frankly, a fairly neutral, I don't have a stance one way or the other. I was just interested in how meat, what we think about meat. That's pretty much the bottom line for me. And I'm not surprised now that people assume that since I don't attack corporations, since I don't attack the way we make meat, that therefore automatically I'm on the so-called other side, that it's just not true. And, you know, it's just part of it comes with the package, I guess.
Right. That's certainly something that, you know, Peggy and I think have seen in the book. In fact, you're very careful not to pit this as a story of good versus evil. You know, you don't say that the small family farmer is right and big meat companies are wrong. Really, you say that the system was set up to fill the need that Americans continue to have for cheap meat.
And cheap food overall. As a historian, my main interest is in what it is to be an American. You know, how as an American do I see the world? That's sort of been the thematic device that links all four of the books I've written. And that was really my only intention in writing this book. Food is an extraordinarily difficult thing to write about. And if you can use food to kind of get at something, you can learn a great deal about who people are. So all this political stuff that's been attached to it, I was sort of prepared for it because I've spent much of the last 7 years following the so-called food debate. And so I was aware of it. But of course, now it's become very personal in a way that I wish it weren't. I would really prefer that people just read the book on its own terms.
Speaking of that, Maureen, and you're talking about how we view ourselves as Americans, I thought the chapter that is called The Vacuum at the Top was really fascinating because you profiled Americans who really were at the start of how the industry changed dramatically. For instance, Ken Monfort out in Colorado, Andy Anderson in Iowa. And this entire concept, and this is something I just learned in the last couple of years too, and I think our listeners will be interested. Ken Monfort came up with the idea of boxed beef, and that radically changed the industry. Could you please give us an explanation of boxed beef?
Right. I'm trying to figure out the... part of the problem with meat was that the system of making meat changed very slowly. And as a result, meat prices for urban consumers weren't going down as fast as people had hoped they would, particularly after World War II. The population was growing very quickly, and American meat producers were having trouble keeping up. And part of the hang-up, the sort of bottleneck, was in the distribution of it. These are the kinds of things on which a food system hangs. How efficient is it to distribute what you've made? I was astounded to learn how important that was. And what happened in the 1950s was that grocery stores said, look, you've just got to figure out some way to get this meat to us more efficiently. Don't keep sending us half carcasses and whole carcasses that we have to deal with ourselves. It's adding too much to the cost. Our labor costs are going up like crazy. A meat department at the time was gobbling all the profit of any grocery chain. So grocery stores said, please give us a way to make this more efficient. And Ken Monfort decided that what he would do is break the carcass down at his packing plant. And I know that seems like the obvious thing to do, but at the time, that's not how it was happening. Meat producers were simply slaughtering the animals and shipping out these carcasses. Monfort decided instead to break down the carcasses into what are called primal cuts and then vacuum pack those using what at the time was a pretty revolutionary high-tech technology, and then ship just those boxes of beef rather than entire carcasses. The shipping costs were much cheaper, and the beef itself ended up in much better shape in the grocery store. If you ship a carcass, the carcass gets badly damaged en route to its final destination. So the whole point of boxed beef was not to drive out unions, which is what the critics argue. It was actually the result of a plea on the part of grocers, for God's sake, find a way to reduce our distribution and handling costs so we can lower the cost to the consumer.
And that basically then created, the meat factories that we have today, because it made it very efficient.
It made it very efficient, but there is one other element that explains why we have meatpacking factories that are as extraordinarily efficient as they are right now. And that is that during World War II, there was so much government research into the use of plastics and other chemically based products that meat packers began to lose the profits from their byproducts. Meat packers have always relied on byproducts to subsidize the cost of beef and pork in particular. I'm talking about hides, bone, thyroid, things like that. In the wake of World War II, for example, shoe manufacturers weren't particularly interested in using leather, and all of a sudden packers were losing that narrow band of profit that allowed them to kind of keep the fresh meat system going. So they had to strip every conceivable efficiency out of their meatpacking plants, and they did that in part by redesigning them, by moving them out of cities, and yes, by designing packing plants where people with no skill could do the work. It did mean cutting out unions because they had to figure out a way to reduce costs.
I want to get back to that, but I would love to take a call. We've had a caller on hold for a minute now. Steve from Roland Park. Steve, do you have a question?
Steve from Roland Park.
Hi. Are you on there, Steve?
Yes.
Do you have a question here for our guest?
I just wanted to comment on and observe that before World War II, as a nation, according to what I read anyway, that we were largely eating grass-fed meat. And that cheap grain driven by chemical industry is what made this feedlot industry possible during and after World War II. And and I'd like to comment on the environmental impact, too. Grass-fed meat that's raised with certain kinds of pasture management and grazing management can be a benefit for the environment and sequester more carbon in the future. And I think there's opportunities there for profit as well for corporations and individual ranchers and grazers. And I wonder if any of that's in the author's book.
Great.
And I'd like to hear any comments on that.
Great. Thanks, Steve. And Maureen, I think there were two parts there, and I know that you do kind of treat both of them at length in the book. You talk a lot about the development of our meat industry in recent times, as far as organic and as far as the differences in grass-fed and corn-fed. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and there are two parts there. First of all, I cover both the emergence of those big commercial feedlots that he's talking about and taking animals off pasture. There's a big section in the book devoted to that. And then at the end of the book, there's a long section about the current mania for grass feeding. Americans have always used corn to finish cattle. They've been doing that since the colonial period. By the time the American Revolution broke out, there was already a well-developed system of finishing cattle on corn, because it was actually better for the cattle to get themselves to market having been fed on corn. Right before and during, especially during World War II, there was a tremendous population growth in the western half of the United States, and it was extremely difficult to get meat supplies to those people, particularly during World War II, because there were shortages of everything, not least of which were ways to transport just about everything. And meat packers found that if they wanted to supply food to urbanites in the western half of the United States, they were going to have to figure out a way to feed them more efficiently because historically, cattle in particular had been finished on corn on Midwestern farms. So these big feedlots emerged. Another factor that drove them was that ranchers were being systematically pushed off the range. They didn't have enough land to graze cattle on grass. And that meant, as Ken Monfort, I quote Ken Monfort in the book as saying, you know, we're going to have to raise more of our cattle in a finishing feedlot on corn because we don't have any grazing land. So the whole system of commercial feedlots doesn't have anything to do with commodities. It doesn't have anything to do with big chemical corporations. It has to do with a lot of really practical reasons over a period of about 15 years. And the grass feeding thing actually came into vogue in the late 1990s. And I agree, it's probably ecologically more correct or beneficial to raise cattle on grass, but there's a big problem. Where are you going to find the pasture land to do that? Farmers are constantly competing with other buyers for land. Farmers, one of the things that has driven animals into confinement in the first place was farmers flat out couldn't afford the land to raise animals on pasture. They couldn't afford it because they were constantly being outbid. So they made the decision to come up with a more efficient way to raise livestock by confining them in a smaller space because it would cost them less money and the resulting livestock would be cheaper and therefore so would the meat. So it's a very complicated story. I understand everything the caller is talking about. And as again, I'm just the person who's offering up the explanations here.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to join Steve and join our conversation, that number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us updatedate@kcur.org. Maureen, one of the most fascinating parts that I found in the book, as a historian, you trace the roots of our meat intake and the meat system all the way back to colonial America. In the early days of the country, as you write, settlers found themselves in a new place with all this space all of a sudden. And as you were alluding to, raising meat, certainly at that point, took a lot of space. So how did that sow the seeds to this society obsessed with meat that we have today?
I think that might have been the one thing that surprised me more than anything else. As a historian, I knew that the people who settled North America in the 17th century came from a land of scarcity. That's one of the reasons they left. There wasn't enough of anything. Europeans, and especially the English, had suffered for centuries from shortages of land, raw materials, food, everything. So when the settlers came here, they were, as I say in the book, I think their greatest cultural shock was just sheer abundance. They had no mental or intellectual experience with abundance like that. And the people who settled, the English people who settled North America, believed firmly in their God's mandate to go forth and exercise control and dominion over all living creatures. And they also regarded livestock husbandry and meat eating as signs of civilization. When they came to the New World, what they encountered were Native Americans who did not farm in a conventional sense and who kept no domesticated animals. And so the combination of the need to impose civilization on this wilderness very clearly almost from day one drove colonists to expand their livestock out into the wilderness. That's one of the biggest factors that pushed Indians deeper and deeper into the interior. I was really astounded at how much conflict was due to whites' insistence that, A, the land belonged to them because they ate meat and raised livestock, and B, just how fast they built a very intensive land use system devoted to making livestock. It was really remarkable to me. And from that, by the time the revolution came out, everyone who lived here, everyone except slaves, every white person assumed that meat should be theirs as often as they wanted. Even indentured servants were quite happy to just sit down and refuse to work unless they were given meat whenever they wanted it. It was remarkable.
And that's almost stretched, you know, to today. I'd love to give a call here, Ben. Ben in Leawood. Hi, Ben.
Leawood. Yes. My question is, what would the I didn't get your name on the book, but what would you think if the government just got out of the meat business altogether and actually crops altogether with price supports and all kinds of other things? Land has gone up so much in value. And obviously, it doesn't pay for the farmer to farm it. I mean, he farms it, but there's no way good farmland in Iowa and Nebraska, good farmland goes for $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 an acre now. And of course, they can never get their money out of that. The other comment I want to make is that I remember, I'm 76 and a half, I remember during World War II, we had the stamps that you used to buy fruits and vegetables, and there's only so much meat. But if you didn't have enough meat, if you couldn't get enough with your stamps, all you have to do is go out and buy one steer, take it to the local place. They'll butchered the steer for you and couldn't cut it up. And my father, for example, I remember vividly, he couldn't understand why they had food rationing during World War II, because if you didn't get enough food from your stamps, you could just go out and eat 10 restaurants every day. So that's how I'll pick your comments off the radio.
Ben, thanks so much.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So, Maureen, the first part of Ben's question there about government support, at least to the agriculture industry, how does that play into our meat industry currently?
Well, I knew very little about the whole agricultural subsidy system before I wrote the book, Ben. Naturally, I had to educate myself thoroughly. And boy, is that a complicated issue. And I joined the caller in wondering what would happen if there were no supports. For what it's worth, the support system was originally designed to make sure that the farmers who were making cheap food for urbanites could enjoy income parity with those urbanites. The problem with farmers was they were all dumping their crops on the market at the same time at harvest time, and of course that glut would drive down the money that they would earn from those crops, but would allow urbanites to earn cheap food. That is at the core of the agricultural system, subsidy system that we have now, which of course has now turned into this insane mess. In fact, I devote a long section of the book to explaining how in the 1970s consumer advocates entered the fray of the farm bill negotiations and made farm bill negotiations even more complicated than they already were. As I suspect most of your listeners know, the farm bill has been dragging on for months now, and that's in part because there are all these competing special interests, and I don't mean by that big commodities, big corporations. I mean consumer groups, consumer advocacy, public interest groups, all demanding their share of it. Frankly, if farmers were to lose all their subsidies, I maybe we should just try it and find out. I don't know. I've thought about it a lot. I'm pretty sure food prices would go up real fast is what I think.
That's certainly the argument.
Yeah.
Dave, I want to get to your call. Dave from KCK.
Hi. My point would be, why are we prolonging the inevitable? The amount of energy that's required to raise corn-fed cattle, feedlot or otherwise, the amount of fossil fuel energy that has to be provided to grow the crops, feed the animals, transport the animals, do all the processing, that's all going away. We might as well just get used to the fact that small-scale farming, the small-scale grass-fed operations, they're the only ones that aren't subsidized right now. To any great degree, yet they do just fine on the basis of the price of their beef. So talk about that, please.
Well, I'll be glad to. The problem when people say let's just shift to small farming, I have two questions. Where are you going to get the land for that, especially for pasture grazing? And my other bigger, more important question that no one will answer is, where exactly are we going to get the farmers? Part of the issue that has been driving agriculture in this country for more than a century is lack of labor. The more people who moved to cities, the fewer people there were to work on a farm. During World War II, farmers just faced such extraordinary labor shortages that German prisoners of war were imported to the United States to help farmers. And after World War II, the labor shortages got even worse. That is one of the big factors that has driven the kind of livestock production and agriculture crop production system that we have today. So I understand exactly why people are saying, look, these small farmers don't have subsidies. Let's just go this direction. But you've really got to answer first two questions first. Where are you going to get the farmers and where are those farmers going to get land? Because as I said earlier, everybody's in competition for farmland. The previous caller pointed out, I live in Iowa. Cropland is going there for $10,000 an acre now. I'm not quite sure how we're going to be able to switch over to small farms. I think at heart, this is my personal opinion now, based on thinking about this for 7 years, if people have a complaint about the meat system, the easiest, fastest way to change it, not that it will be easy, not that it will be fast, is just cut down on how much meat you eat. I knew I would get interviewed when this book came out by many people, so I started keeping track of how much meat I eat, and I was astounded to discover I think I eat a lot of meat. I eat 25 pounds of meat a year. On average, per capita, Americans eat 227 pounds of meat a year. who in the heck is eating all that meat? And do we really need to eat that much meat? I mean, I think 25 pounds a year is a lot. So as long as the demand is there, we're going to continue to have these very large industrial systems, because that's the only way to satisfy demand. You're not going to satisfy demand with small farmers. You're just, it's not going to happen.
Along the same vein, there's been a lot written about organic meat and how that has kind of come in and out of fad mm-hmm. in various forms for the last 40 years or so. In the 80s, the Agriculture Department created an official organic certification process for producers so that they can be officially organic. But that's complicated the pricing structure. That's made it very expensive for many of these farms to produce their meat and be competitive in any way, even acknowledging that organic meat is going to be at a premium. So what does organic mean today, and how does that play into, as you were alluding to there, the different options that we have for meat?
Oh, boy. How much time have we got?
That's a simple question, I'm sure.
The whole labeling system, natural, organic, the current controversy over country of origin labeling, all of it's incredibly complicated. Every time you impose a labeling regulation, you add to the expense on the part of the producer, which is one reason why a lot of farmers, especially ones who only sell at farmers markets, as I noted in the book, decide not to even go for their organic certification, because it requires tremendous amounts of paperwork, all kinds of rigmarole, and it's just simply too expensive. I have a very funny anecdote in the book from Joel Salatin, who was made famous in Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, who got completely infuriated when he wanted to try to start actually processing this livestock on his farm and discovered he was going to have employee bathrooms even though he had no employees, and he was going to have lockers for them even though he had no employees. So the complaint on the part of critics is that organic labeling systems have been made unnecessarily burdensome as a way to allow big meat producers to maintain their edge and to keep little guys out of business. I don't think it's quite that simple. Americans are kind of obsessed with labeling and regulations. And of course, the USDA, let's face it, is a big bureaucracy, and bureaucrats exist to perpetuate their positions. And so, yeah, it's organic means that the animal from which the meat came never ate anything that was not so-called natural. It fed on pasture that has never been touched with fertilizer, herbicides, pesticides. If it was fed any grain, all that grain was raised organically. It's been slaughtered in a slaughterhouse that's been certified to handle organic materials. And so you can see all these layers of complications.
There's a lot there, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is. It's an incredibly complicated subject.
Well, you can read more about it in Maureen Ogle's new book. It's called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. She joined us today from NPR's New York Bureau. Peggy Lowe is a reporter for Harvest Public Media here at KCUR. Maureen, Peggy, thank you all so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Let's take a break. When we return, the story behind StoryCorps. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld sitting in for Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.